Dan Clark Talks Films on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Screen Talk with me, Dan Clark. I am sat here recording this show from my laptop. I'm in an Airbnb. I've been away for the last 2 weeks, but I'm committed to this show. So whilst I've been away, I've actually been interviewing people because I'm dedicated to bring you this show on a weekly basis. This show, if you're a first listener, this is a show where I talk to producers, writers, directors, actors, comedians, composers, editors. It can be anyone who works in the world of film and television. We discuss their influences, things they like, their work, and a guilty pleasure, a film that they love, even though they know it's shit. Or maybe they don't think it's shit. Maybe they think it's misunderstood or an underrated classic. Today's guest is Dean Craig. He's a screenwriter who, he's someone I've known for a while. And I'm very happy to be chatting to him. He's had, 5-6 screenplays of his filmed, which is it's an amazing achievement. If you know anything about this business, you know how difficult it is to get stuff financed and distributed. And Dean has actually got a proper long CV of work that has been made. So we'll chat about his work and his guilty pleasure, something I was very, very excited about. First of all, I'll kickstart the show with a song. We like to play songs on this show, always from films, could be from TV, and it could be score. This is a song by Jose Gonzalez, or Josie Gonzalez, as I like to call him. This is from the film Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which was a film that was released a few years back. Ben Stiller wrote it, directed it. He starred in it. And I think this unfortunately didn't do brilliant business at the box office. I don't know why. Maybe it was too sweet. Maybe it was something to do with the way it was released, you know, what people thought it was going to be. But I actually really like this film. I mean, it's not perfect. It's got holes, most films have. But there was something about it that just really touched me. I love the sentiment of it. And of all the films that Ben Stiller has directed, I think this is the best film he's directed. Just from a directing point of view, I think I love the cinematography, the locations, the production design. There's just a great feel. I actually also really love the score. I'm not talking about the songs, although I love the songs as well, but the score was beautiful. And this song by Jose Gonzalez was kind of used, parts of its motifs and hooks were used in the score as well, but this is a song from the soundtrack, and it's one of my favorites. Here you go.
There's a rhythm and rush these days, where the lights don't move and the colors don't fade. Leaves you empty with nothing but dreams, in a world gone shallow, in a world gone mean. Sometimes there's things a man cannot know. The gears won't turn and the leaves won't grow. There's no place to run and no gasoline. Engine won't turn and the train won't bleed. Engines won't turn and the train won't leave. I will stay with you tonight, hold you close to the morning. Watch the new day rise. Do whatever just to stay alive. Do whatever. there's a rhythm and rush these days, where the lights don't move and the colors don't fade. Leaves you empty with nothing but dreams, in a world gone shallow, in a world gone mean. But there is a truth and it's on our side. Dawn is coming, open your eyes. Look into the sun as a new day's rise.
That was Stay Alive by Jose Gonzalez. Now, a bit of film news before I introduce our first and only guest for today's show. There's been some pictures released of Thomas Cruise Mappatha III on the set of The Mummy. They're doing a reboot of The Mummy. Of course they are. Everything needs to be rebooted at some point. If it's been 5 years, I think that warrants a reboot. Or in the case of Spider-Man, 6 months. But there's some photos released, and it just got me thinking, like, where's the Tom that did films like Jerry Maguire, Magnolia, even though at the time that was still kind of a weird choice for him, but brilliant. A Few Good Men, Cocktail. But, you know, joking aside, I love Cocktail. You know, the sort of more, the comedy dramas and the acting films. And, you know, Tom isn't like a character actor, we all know that. But when he's on fire, I think Tom Cruise is amazing. And, of course, I have to separate the man from the artist, because obviously there's some questionable things there. But, you know, I love Tom Cruise films. What can I say? I think the man has a charm, and he's just fucking watchable. He's just great, I think. I do love the Mission Impossible films. I particularly love the recent ones. They're really fun. But I just want him to do a few more, I don't know, just a few more like Jerry Maguire's. You know, where's Jerry Maguire 2, 3, and, you know, Magnolia 4? What else is in the news? In the news, it has been announced that Joe McHale from Community, the TV series Community, is going to play Chevy Chase in a film for Netflix about the founders of National Lampoon. Can't really see the similarities there, but he's a good comic actor, and I'm really excited about this film, because it's definitely a very important part of comedy, both in just generally across the board, but specifically in movies. And I wonder how Chevy Chase is going to be portrayed, because he's not a man with a great reputation, but someone I adore. Going back to the first Vacation, Fletch, he's just a great, and of course SNL. What other news do we have? Oh yeah, this caught my attention. Bit of news here. Andy Serkis's Jungle Book Origins, pushed back to 2018. That's Andy Serkis's. This is Jungle Book Origins. So I presume this is like, well, it can't be Mowgli, because he's already a kid and we already know the origins. So is it like, I don't know, Baloo when he was a baby bear or something? I mean, this whole origins thing and building out universes seems to be, you know, a thing of the moment. And I, you know, there's been rumors, or I think it's actually been confirmed, that there's going to be a Men in Black 21 Jump Street crossover, which, by the way, I love Men in Black films and I love the Jump Street films, so I'm intrigued. But it's just crazy that it's gone beyond the superhero films, and now they're going to start doing it with everyone. I wonder where this will go. You know, I'd love it if they started doing that with serious films, with there'd be a crossover between Mike Lee's, you know, Life is Sweet and Ken Loach's Kes. You know, if they started doing it in really sort of kitchen sink dramas. I doubt they will. I don't know if you can build Ken Loach's universe. Be interesting. But this film has been pushed back. I wonder if it's because, obviously, there's The Jungle Book that's coming out, I think, over in this country. It's out next week, I think. And then probably next month over there. So that's the film news. So my guest today is Dean Craig. Dean is a screenwriter. You may know some of his work. He wrote the films A Few Best Men, the forthcoming sequel A Few Less Men, Moonwalkers, which is coming out soon, Death at a Funeral, and Death at a Funeral.
Dan Clark talks films on FUBAR Radio.
Dean?
Hello, Dean. Hi.
Let's start with that film, because I think that's probably the film that was, for you and your career, kind of the pivotal moment.
Still is.
Still is. Are you a bit annoyed that we're still talking about it?
No. I love talking about it.
It's weird that you... It's not many people get to do the same film twice with a complete... I mean, they couldn't be so more different as well.
Well, do you know what? You say they couldn't be more different, but there is one that is even more different, which is the Bollywood musical version of the film.
Are you serious?
Yeah, do you not know
about that? No, I did not know that. God, I haven't done my research. Yeah. I actually was looking at your IMDb and there is no mention of that one.
Well, interestingly, they didn't credit me. Oh. But if you look at the film or look at the...
Rather than watch it, just look at it.
Yeah, I would probably recommend that. But it's... they didn't... They kind of snuck it under the radar a little bit, the film. And then someone... at one point sent me a trailer to it and said, isn't this your film? Didn't you do this? Anyway, and I looked at it and it's basically, it is Death at a Funeral. It was like watching the trailer for Death at a Funeral, but with Indian actors who looked vaguely like the actors that did the English one. Bizarrely. So it's very kind of bizarro world. And they didn't, but they seemed not to be able to find a dwarf for the Peter Dinklage part. So it's just a small man.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing. That's like, they were like, even though this is a remake, we must try and cast them as close to the original as possible, even though it's a totally different race. So how come you didn't know it was happening?
Because they just didn't tell anyone. They just went off and made it, I guess.
That's not allowed, is it?
it's certainly not allowed here. And so...
I can't imagine you're the sort of person that's like, right, we're going to sue the shit out of these people. But did you try and sue the shit out of them?
Well, not personally. No. But I basically told the production company and I said, you know, you might want to know about this little thing that's going on. So then they kind of worked something out.
Okay. And I mean, it's a shame it's not a masterpiece, the Bollywood version, because how great would it be to have like cornered? We've got the UK comedy version. We have the American black cast version. We have the amazing Bollywood. I mean, it would just be, what would you need to do next? You'd need to do like a Chinese John Woo version.
That is the next one, isn't it? Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I have watched some of the film. I didn't watch it to its completion, but then I hadn't. Then someone said to me, "But what did you think of the end credits?" And I was like, "I don't know. I haven't seen the end credits." And we watched the end credits, and it's basically about 50 women dancing in lingerie, which is a really weird ending to the film. It seems to have nothing to do with anything, but and it's got songs in it, and it's got like music videos. It's quite, you know,
if you like those Bollywood films, then
it's called Daddy Cool, is what they called it. They changed the name.
So they also stole somebody else's song title as well. Wow, this is just a bunch of thieves making films. So you probably shot Death at a Funeral in 2006 or something.
Shot in 2006, yeah.
Because it was out in 2007. And is this a film that you... it's not your first film, though, is it?
No, it was my second film.
I haven't seen your first film. I was going through your credits, and you're a bit like, what? why haven't you watched everything I've done in preparation? What was your first film?
So my first film was a film called Caffeine.
Yeah. Which is an American movie, right?
Well, it was a sort of a weird scenario because it was certainly written as an English film set in an English coffee shop. But then it was taken on by an American director and producer, and the plan was always to make it still English. And then at a certain point he said, you know what, we're not going to be able to make this in England, we're going to make it here in LA. And I was like, okay, so we're going to transpose it to America? He's like, no, it will still be English and an English coffee shop. But what ended up happening was they got some English actors and then quite a few American actors to play English people. Which, as you know, is always a recipe for success.
Wasn't the poster is just selling the film on all the American actors?
Yes. Well, the American actors were far more prominent. Yeah.
You go into it thinking, okay, here's an American film, and then everyone's suddenly English.
It must be quite a bizarre experience to watch it when you don't know what's going
to
happen.
How do you feel about the film? Because it sounds to me like a lot of after you wrote it, a lot of the process of making it was you didn't necessarily have much involvement. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, not that I didn't have much involvement, but I certainly didn't have much power or say over the creative direction the film took.
But you must have been really excited that your film was getting made.
Well,
right?
there was a lot of sort of all sorts of feelings going on at the same time.
You were also an adolescent, so you were going through puberty.
I was 12.
How old were you?
I was 30. 30.
30, right, yeah.
So I was very, it was amazingly exciting. I was I came to LA for the shooting of the film, and it was the first thing I'd ever written. It was the first thing I had made, and it was... suddenly I'm in Hollywood. It was amazing.
Watching Americans speaking with English accents, doing the script, going, how I imagined it.
Exactly. And then we had this brilliant dialect coach. She was kind of this woman, I don't remember her name, unfortunately, but she'd done sort of so many, really good films, and she was really excellent at her job. But after 3 days, she left the film and went off to do, I think, a Roman Polanski film. So then we were in a bit of a situation where we had six American actors doing English accents and no dialect coach.
Okay.
And then I tried to be the dialect coach. Which
by
is a
just
role
going,
I hadn't
copy me.
Say it exactly how I say it. But that's not the perfect way of doing it. Okay.
So you did that film, Caffeine, and then your next film was Death at a Funeral.
Yeah.
Did Caffeine help you get that, or was that...
I think so. I mean, I'd... It
must help that suddenly you are a writer with an actual film that's been made.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. And there's this sort of the element that before the film comes out, then you... No one knows whether it's going to be good or bad or whatever. So people are quite excited about you, and you have a little bit of...
a little window of heat.
You have a window of heat and of hope. And so I was in LA, and so I was able to, on the back of having had Caffeine made, I was able to get an agent and my lawyer. The lawyer came first, actually. I think that's the way to do it, maybe.
Some of the listeners here won't fully understand, like, a lawyer? Why have you got a lawyer? Like, is that to cover your back in case you do something wrong? But you have to have a lawyer here. You know, back home you have an agent that does all your everything for you. Here you have like several different people who represent you, and I guess probably because there's more money to be made in LA.
So everyone takes some commission.
Yeah.
And but the lawyer is an entertainment lawyer who specializes in entertainment law, and so helps you to do your contracts, and
someone
is a very important
maybe
person.
You should have spoken to after the Bollywood film.
I'm sure I did. I'm sure. I mean, he was probably my first phone call.
So you went with Death at a Funeral. Did you spec that script, or was it an idea that you pitched?
I spec'd it.
Do you like doing that? Is that a thing you prefer doing than... I've sort of found myself getting nervous of pitching something in case people don't fully, for an industry that is based on imagination, there's a lot of people that seem not to have it. So you kind of want to sort of, by having a script, it you know, there's no ambiguity about your vision of it.
Exactly. I think, you know, you're if you're depending on people's imaginations, you're hoping that they're going to see what you want them to see, and it just doesn't work like that in reality. And I think with Death at a Funeral, for example, it would have been a very difficult film to pitch, because then you're saying, I don't even know how I would pitch it. It's like, so it's a comedy, but it's set at a funeral. So that already doesn't sound great from a pitching perspective. And then to try to describe all the characters and the details, and, you know, I just think it would have been...
It's all pretty much in one house.
It's all in one house. Yeah. It's almost in real time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not the best pitch.
It's a terrible pitch.
So are there explosions? Are there what's...
Exactly. There's nothing, you know. So all the comedy, you sort for the really funny moments to feel funny, I think you need to have explained everything that leads up to that moment.
Right.
So
and the characters.
Yeah.
And the,
so it would be a really long pitch as well. So anyway, so I wrote it on spec, and there is something about doing, and I kind of haven't had time to do one of those lately, but there's something about writing something with no one else's eyes on it, where it's just you, and you're just doing exactly what you think is the right way to go about it. And there's a certain purity in that kind of writing.
And also there's, when something from my experience is when you write, when you're being paid to write and you know that you're trying to get this commit, like greenlit, you start doing the second guessing thing in your head of like, do they want this? Maybe they won't want this. So then you're not really writing in the moment, as it were.
Yeah.
And that's another tough thing that I think people forget, that you know, it's not just about writing, it's also the politics of writing as well, you know.
Very true, yeah. And so at that point, when I wrote that film, I didn't have really a sense of what people would want, what Hollywood would want, or what my agent would want, or anything like that. So it was, there was sort of no politics involved, and I was writing it as something. My direction with that was that I'm going to write this very, very small, makeable £100,000 film that I will be able to direct, and that was it.
And it will be big introduction to the world.
Yeah. But I don't even know. I mean, I probably was thinking of it, my introduction to the world, but I wasn't thinking, oh, it's going to be a big success or anything like that. I just wanted to make it, and I felt like this could be good.
This was your Rocky.
except that I went a different direction to Rocky, so...
I see a lot of similarities.
Well, you know, I mean, you're referring to the Sylvester Stallone story that, I guess, where he was offered, like, a lot of money for his script.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, no.
Well, they offered him a lot of money if they could put a star in it. And he was like, I'll take less, but in it. Which I've tried many times, and it's never worked. So were you doing other jobs at the time? Were you having to do a day job? Or
At the time I was writing Death at a Funeral, actually, and Caffeine was hopefully going to go into production at that point. I was working as a PA, a personal assistant for a man.
Just for a man?
For a man, yeah. Just wow. This man hired me.
Okay.
So will you do my... personal stuff.
Yeah. And you're like, but I must know what you do. And he's like, I don't want you to ever know.
No.
Just do my laundry, pick up my coffees.
It was, yeah.
Was he someone in the business?
It was in the business, yes. He was someone that worked in distribution, and he was a very, very eccentric individual and extraordinarily difficult to work for in every way, which was good in a way because it made me very motivated. I was like, Jesus, this script has to be really fucking good, otherwise I may have to stay working for this man.
Well, it's good. I think that's something that once you make enough money to not have to do the day job, it does maybe take some of that drive out of you a bit, or that
you definitely need. Maybe you don't feel that need to like stay up till 3 a.m. and, you know, and just sort of torture yourself over every line and every scene in the way that you do when you're
Although I did,
desperate.
I've often thought, beat myself up about like how much do I struggle for my art, that sort of thing. Mm. And then I was reading the Difficult Men book, which is about all those showrunners that did, you know, Breaking Bad and Sopranos and stuff. And David Chase, he sort of suffered the same thing, that he was a relatively successful TV writer but worked on shows as a member of the staff.
Mm.
So he had a nice lifestyle. And he used to feel guilty because, you know, he would be like, he always wanted to be a filmmaker and be this struggling man that goes and makes his piece of art. But it didn't stop him from making, you know, one of the greatest TV shows of all time. Mm. And possibly even in the world of cinema as well, just one of the greatest pieces of storytelling. Mm. So, you know, whenever I think, oh, you know, I'm sort of sitting around doing nothing today, I feel bad. I just think of David Chase.
That's what to do.
Not but that he did nothing.
No, no. Very, but I think most writers have that, don't they? Where they're sitting around doing nothing a lot of the time and feeling guilty. And
it's
awful.
So you spec'd it, and then did you just sent it around and people...
Well,
did you get a good reaction straight away? Did you need to do lots of rewrites?
So what had happened is I took on these producers. So a guy called Larry Malkin and Cher Stallings were the producers. That,
brilliant names.
Yeah,
I hope you hired them based purely on their name.
That was all. Yeah. That was the only reason. The
second guy's name, Cher.
Cher Stallings is a lady.
Okay. Yeah. So like Cher.
Yeah, C-H? and I was staying at her house, and I would always refer to I'm staying at Cher's house, and people did think that I was staying at the Cher.
Amazing. Yeah. And I hope you didn't correct them.
No, of course not.
Good.
And then suddenly I got this phone call from Cher saying Frank Oz wants to direct this film, and he's going to call you to discuss it. So then so that was a weird...
So again, like, you must have been both disappointed and really excited. Or just disappointed.
Yeah, no, it was... very excited.
But he has directed some amazing films, like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, What About Bob, and Bowfinger I Love as well. Mm. So... this is a guy that knows what he's doing. You must have been like, fuck, okay, this is...
Well, yeah, and suddenly, like, when you're looking at Dean Craig, age 30, whatever, I think he was still 30, directing, or Frank Oz, with quite an incredible career behind him, it was a difficult matchup for me, to be frank. And then...
Did you at any point try and fight for, like, look, Frank is brilliant, like, movie.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of conversations with people about it. And look, you know, there is a parallel universe where I said no, and we don't know what happened. Well, either the film never got made, or I directed it and it was amazing, or I directed it and it was terrible. Yeah, there's all sorts of possibilities which we'll never know about. But
So then, and you mentioned the cast, a brilliant cast, it was early Dinklage.
Yeah.
Who did you even imagine he would go on to be such a global superstar?
Well, I already knew about him, of course, from Station Agent. So
I love that film so much.
Brilliant film, and he is brilliant in it. So yeah, it was.
Why was it weird that people were like, "Wow, like a dwarf that can really act," like those two things were mutually exclusive or something. There was like a real revelation that
it's very true. And I think what was sort of groundbreaking about Peter Dinklage is that he, who was in my dream the other night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Strangely.
Is it a dream you can talk about?
it was, and I told the person, two nights ago, I was attending my female friend's wedding,
right?
And she was getting married to Peter Dinklage.
Brilliant!
It was. I don't know why. I have nothing. There's nothing more. Intrigued.
Yeah, maybe we'll spend a bit of time
analyzing.
Yeah, after the show.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, what it was quite groundbreaking about him, I think, is that with the Station Agent, as far as I'm aware, that was a part that was not written for a dwarf. It was
really
written for,
oh wow.
But I think that Tom McCarthy sort of found Peter Dinklage and was...
We've just got to use this guy.
Yeah.
Just to add to... And then he's really the one link, other than yourself, of course, to the remake, which we cut to like 5 years later, and suddenly you're doing the film again in America.
Not even 5 years. It was actually 2 years after the release that we went into production on the remake. Yeah.
Okay. And how did that come about? That was Chris Rock starring in. Did he produce it as well? Or
He did, yeah. So the way that came about was that Chris Rock was sitting in a cinema watching the original Death at a Funeral. And I think he was watching it in a sort of an arty cinema, because the way they released the film in the US was almost like an art film, which is quite odd. But And he was aware that, and he became aware that he was the only black person to have seen the movie,
right?
Certainly that he knew of. And so he realized there's this whole audience that have never even heard of this film. Let's sort of remake it for a kind of a more commercial audience and an African-American audience who he thought would love it.
But if that's his only remit for remaking films, there must be thousands of films he could remake.
I guess so, yeah.
By the way, as a side note, it is genuinely one of the great titles of a film. Oh, I think you and I have actually spoken about this before, about how difficult it is to come up with titles. And I mean, it's just brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I remember when I came up with it, some people thought it was quite depressing because it's got death and funeral in the title.
Yeah, I suppose. You could, if you did a different poster with it, it could be, but...
Yeah, if it was a drama, it would really...
Yeah, you'd be like, oh my God, how much death is there?
Yeah, but yeah, I was quite... I did like it, and I think I have to credit the film, the play and film Murder by Death, which was a Neil Simon...
Yeah, yeah.
Film and play, which I remember really loving actually when I was a kid, and it just sort of stuck in my head. So,
and did you enjoy the process of remaking the movie in America? The original was in, even though it had American director and producers attached, it was all shot in the UK, right?
The original, yes.
So then this one was, did you enjoy that process, or was there any kind of, oh no, that's not how the film was?
Well, what was quite, what was more relaxing about the remake than I have had with other films is that, there's always that one, the original one there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you don't, in a really weird set of circumstances, this was not my only shot at getting this film right. So, from that perspective, it was good, but it was, you know, like the truth is, the original one was the one that was really close to me, where I was on set every day and working very closely with Frank, and it was very much felt like my movie. And of course, when you get to America and doing an American movie that's also a studio movie with people like Chris Rock, with a director like Neil LaBute, who's obviously done a lot of stuff and a lot of great stuff.
That was kind of a weird choice as well.
Yeah, very unusual.
Yeah, but then he has made quite a lot of odd choices since his early... Because he was a sort of indie darling, wasn't he?
Yes.
And then he's made some films that sort of made people slightly scratch their head, as in like, so what kind of director are you now?
And I think he probably likes that about it, just the idea that, of just doing something, this is quite different for me, I'll do it.
Yeah, yeah. See, I like that in people that have the courage to do that and not worry about how people are perceiving their career.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some people get a bit too bogged down with that.
It's easy to see why, because people get so criticized and, you know. But he is someone that, I remember him sort of saying that he feels pretty much privileged to be invited anywhere to direct. I mean, it's an amazing thing to be asked to direct a film. So.
Yeah.
He's not...
And this would have been a studio movie as well?
It was a studio movie,
so a privilege for someone like him to do a studio film as well.
And a comedy, and something that's very clearly a comedy, but that isn't, it's dark, but it's not as dark as his stuff often goes.
And he'd worked with Chris Rock before, hadn't he, on the...
Yes.
What was the film with... Was it Nurse Betty? Was he in Nurse Betty?
Maybe it was
Nurse
that.
Nurse Betty.
Yes.
Is it called Nurse Betty?
I think so.
With Renee Zellweger?
Yeah. You could be right. I don't know.
Okay, I should do my homework.
Look it up. But it's... Yeah, they definitely worked together before, and, so one wanted to do so again. But anyway, but when you've got all these sort of people, and it was... Yeah, it was a less intimate affair, I would say, and mm-hmm. and you know, you had quite a few big people that were sort of, you know, had what they want. So, you know, my voice was very meek, mm-hmm. I would say, you were
more of a herb than a sort of main piece of meat or a vegetable. I don't know where this analogy's going.
That's pretty. Yeah, that's how I would describe it. Yeah.
Whereas you were the whole dish in the UK.
Not the whole dish, but I was a more substantial part of the dish.
I really wish I hadn't started this strange food analogy. How do you feel about remakes in general? Do you feel like there are any good ones? I was having a little look at some remakes, a list of remakes, and I think the one of the ones that's considered a good remake in that it's either as good as the original or maybe better is The Departed.
Right.
Casino Royale, is that some people say that's a remake, but Ocean's 11.
Wasn't the original Casino Royale?
It was the Peter Sellers
it was a comedy
thing.
Yeah, what was the next
Ocean's
one?
11.
Yeah.
My favourite remake is Three Men and a Baby.
Is that a remake?
It's a remake.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Of a French farce, I think.
Okay.
Which you must know all that, because essentially it's a farce, right?
Death at a Funeral. Yeah, so yes, it is. I didn't sort of initially go out to make a farce, actually, but...
At what point did you realise it was a farce?
I think it was when someone told me.
I like that. I think quite often I write stuff and I feel like I need someone else to tell me what
right.
it is.
Yeah.
And then it sort of helps you because, you know, you can have a vision for something, but maybe your writing style isn't what your vision is, if you know what I mean. You just
yes.
naturally go in a slightly different...
Well, I think that's an interesting point. And actually, the truth, if you want the truth...
No, we want the PR live version. No, go on, the truth, of
is
course.
That when I was first writing Death at a Funeral, my very first like versions of it were, you know, I knew I wanted to set something entirely at a funeral and kind of do something a little bit quirky, but it was much more drama okay. and it was much more real and kind of gritty and, you know, and I was going for that. And actually the films that I tend to watch and tend to like tend to be of that nature, like much more sort of dark and gritty and wrenching. Anyway, and I was writing it like that, and then I think at a certain point I was getting a bit depressed about it. and then I started having these sort of funny ideas, and the funny ideas sort of just led me in that direction. I was like, oh, that would be really funny. Oh, if you fell out of the coffin, that would be really funny, actually. And then I sort of went in that.
Because you wanted to make it more of a comedy, or just because you were trying to cheer yourself up?
Well, it was a mixture, really. But it was really sort of having a better idea, I guess, or having a good idea and just following that. And then in writing it to that direction, then, of course, the tone shifted. And it shifted quite significantly from you know, I'd love to find the very first version of it. But anyway, so it shifted much more into a comedy, and there we go.
And you've got a sequel coming out. This time you're back with funerals.
Well, there is...
What is your obsession with funerals?
I don't know. I'm probably a little bit obsessed with death in general.
Really?
And I suppose my way of dealing with it is to make comedy out of it in some form.
So is it all the same cast returning apart from the one in the coffin?
Yes, it's basically I mean, it's our main it's three of the main guys from the original, but it's a road trip movie.
Okay. And when does that come out?
I think the end of this year. Moonwalkers.
Yeah, which is that out in the UK?
It comes out in the UK in May.
Okay, May, yeah.
But that is a kind of an action comedy of sorts.
It feels a bit different to the other stuff. I've not actually seen it because it's not out yet, but can you describe the plot of that for us?
It's set in 1969, and it's about the basically the plot is that the CIA are planning to film a fake moon landing in case the real one doesn't work out.
Okay.
And so they send the CIA operative, played by Ron Perlman, to London to find Stanley Kubrick to because he's obviously the best person yeah. around, and you may know about the
yeah the rumors. The rumors. He, yeah.
Anyway, but
and
he
there
doesn't.
Was recently, some fake footage
that
of him
was
admitting
weirdly coming out. Yeah. yeah, which came out like 2 days or something before the film got released here.
Really?
Yeah, it was very. It
wasn't
nothing to do with
no.
No, it actually wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Anyway. And so he goes to London and but he doesn't find Stanley Kubrick, but instead finds this kind of young opportunist band manager played by Rupert Grint, who pretends to know Stanley Kubrick so that he can get the money that's on offer. Anyway, and the long story short is that Ron Perlman and Rupert Grint have to end up making this fake moon landing film themselves.
Okay. And is there lots of, you know, how do they fake spaceships and things like that?
Well,
spaceships. Listen
yeah.
to me, I'm sorry. Shuttles. I don't know. What do you call it? Space.
You need the LED.
Yeah.
I think it's called. Anyway, and so they have to hire a director to help do it.
Yeah.
But the only person they know is this kind of insane drug addled kind of German guy, basically, who is like an avant-garde director and who lives in this house full of naked women, and you know, it's just like a constant orgy going on.
Wow.
And so that's the person they get to do it, but without actually telling him what he's really doing.
Okay.
Anyway,
everyone's lying to everyone.
Yeah, there's a lot of lying. There's kind of gangsters involved. There's like other CIA operatives that get, you know, there's sort of, there's certainly some action, some violence. So it's quite, it's got a different kind of, slightly different tone to stuff I've done before.
Yeah. So before we talk about your guilty pleasure, we're going to play your choice of music. Do you want to introduce this one for us?
Yeah, this is White Shade of Pale. This is from the beginning, the very beginning of With Nail and I. It's the live version by Procol Harum.
And just before we play, is this a film? Is this like one of your favorite films? Is this in your top something?
Yeah, this is probably my favorite film. And it's quite annoying.
Ever?
Yeah.
Really?
I think so.
I'm always impressed when people can say they have a favorite film.
Yeah. Well, there's of course others that are, you know, yeah, up there or whatever.
But one just means something to you.
It's got everything that it ticks so many boxes of favorite film. So like, I love it as a film. I also have deep held nostalgia about it. And I think it just it does everything that I want a film to do.
I wonder whether people, whether younger generations are finding this film, because it feels to me like definitely our generation, it was a classic in your teens when your tastes are starting to change a bit. Mm. You'd found this film and it was like everyone just adored this film.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is your choice of song.
Okay.
Shit, I fell. said there is no reason. The truth is plain to see, but I wandered through my playing cards. Would not let her be one of 16 Vestal virgins who are leaving for the coast. And although my eyes were open, they might just as well have been closed. So it was later, as the miller told his tale, that her face at first just ghostly turned a whiter shade of pale.
Really?
No, it's a beautiful piece of music, but yeah. I think remembering the film, there's something very, very tragic about it all.
Well, that is the thing, isn't it? I mean, I love comedy. I think that's the thing. I love comedy and I love tragedy, and this has both in equal measure. And
so we've got an idea of your favourite film, which is always a good thing before we talk about your guilty pleasure, because, you know, I don't want people... I think some people are nervous about talking about guilty pleasure and everyone going, God, is that his taste in, you know, movies or something? But we know you have really good taste in movies. So, but your guilty pleasure is? you can't even say it. Your guilty pleasure is Carry On, Follow That Camel.
Yeah.
Or as it's truly known, just Follow That Camel.
Yeah, or as I found out recently, it was known in the US, I believe, Carry On the Legion or something
like
that.
Legion,
Carry On in the Legion, yeah.
It's one of the only, I think the only other one was Carry On, Don't Lose Your Head, which was technically just Don't Lose Your Head. Why do you love this film so much?
Well, so it's really, it's part of like my love of the Carry On films in general. So when I was young, I have an older brother, and we, for some reason, and so it was him that discovered, and I have to credit him with a lot of my kind of comic influences, because he was always, obviously he was always a few years older than me and still is. And he,
how does he do that?
I know.
It's clever, isn't it?
Trying to catch up, but
yeah.
So he kind of got into the Carry On films, and I was probably about five or six. And so our sort of regular Saturday morning ritual would be to come downstairs and watch VHS like reruns of Carry On films. And we watched every single one over and over again, to the point where we would actually know them off by heart. And of course, at the time, I didn't realize that a lot of the jokes were just going way over my head. And then it was like, and as I was getting older, I was like, oh, I see. Now I understand.
Yeah.
Pear. Right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, but we just loved it. They're so silly. They were actually really good for children, I think, because...
Well, I was going to say, I used to watch them all the time as a kid.
Right.
Really, I adored Carry On films. And I think it probably wasn't until the day I got aroused by the sight of some bosoms that suddenly the meaning of a Carry On film meant something very different.
Right.
Like, it was like that sort of watershed moment where you go, oh, this is not what I thought it was, you know. So then why Follow That Camel of all the Carry On? Because it wouldn't be my favourite Carry On film.
Right.
Weirdly, I always liked the contemporary ones. You know, like the Carry On camping and On At Your Convenience.
I mean,
more than the costume, the period ones. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, I mean, it's just probably a personal taste thing. But I think I was like into I was into history. Like I did a history degree and stuff, and so it was probably that historical element that kind of appealed to me as well. I love Carry On Camping. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably the best one, isn't it? I think
possibly. Yeah,
it's the most carry on. But
what about all the Doctor ones as well? Like, who imagine, you talk about pitching a movie, imagine going to a studio and going, okay, it's a film set in a hospital,
right?
And they're like, and well, that's it. Yeah, it's just in a hospital, people sort of pinching each other's bums,
a lot of people getting injected in the bum by accident.
Yeah,
that would happen in every film.
Who was it? Is it Peter, what was his name? Peter
Butterworth. Yeah.
Was he the one that had a tent over his penis? Because he'd obviously just had some kind... I think he'd... They never say it, but they allude to circumcision or something.
Right.
I mean, this is... Imagine pitching that movie now.
It would be a hard one. But although they are actually doing, apparently, a new Carry On film.
Oh, okay.
And it was interesting because my manager, Josh, called me about it. Because someone had mentioned that they were doing someone had mentioned to him that I would be good for this Carry On film, and he was like, he hadn't even heard of Carry On. He was like, this British thing, Carry On. And it was really interesting because I can't believe I'm even talking about this, because of course I loved the Carry On films, but at the same time to do the updated one, it just feels so. I don't want to say, you know, it could work, I suppose. It just feels like a real challenge.
I'm not convinced.
Because obviously one of the things we love about those films was seeing those same people again and again and getting used to them.
It's troop, isn't
it? And having people like Kenneth Williams in your film.
They work retrospectively as well. I don't think you can do that humour now. Well, you say that. There is a trend in the UK now of slightly more broad, kind of a bit more end of peer ish humor.
Right.
I'm not sure if it's quite as double entendre as that, but
yeah,
don't know. So follow that camel, right?
Follow that camel. Yeah. So I think that what it was partly the historical thing, even though it's not really, you know, accurate historically. And I think it was just the Jim Dale playing it was a very funny setup of Jim Dale playing this sort of upper class English man who goes to the French Foreign Legion, but takes his butler, his manservant, and he basically, you know, he's sort of in the army. He's like a real hardcore army platoon, but he's sort of acting like he's still an upper class guy. And like, you know, he has his manservant running his bath and, getting him dressed in the morning and stuff. And it's just
Hugh Laurie and Blackadder
III. Yeah, there is. It's just a funny setup. It's got Phil Silvers in it, which is quite, it makes it quite
a
unique.
Weird one.
Yeah. It's interesting that Kenneth Williams as well plays someone straight in that film.
Doesn't he in a lot of his film? In a lot
I
of the Carry Ons.
I suppose so, yeah.
I don't think they ever allude to it. I mean...
There's normally an implication, I think.
Is there?
I think so.
I know in Carry On Camping that Hattie Jakes is really trying it on with him.
Yeah, he's normally got women that are trying to...
Because, he's a sex magnet, isn't he? what a strange...
Weird and wonderful world. It was like, there's something very innocent and nostalgic about it.
But also apparently very tragic behind the scenes, you know, like Kenneth Hawtrey was a raging alcoholic. Charles Hawtrey, sorry. Yeah. I think he had his legs amputated at one point. Yeah. You know, they were all sort of, by accounts, sort of sleeping with each other and...
Right.
You know,
they do have, they all have strange stories. Like Hattie Jakes was living in the threesome. Do you know about that?
No, I don't.
She was married to John Le Mesurier, and she, a friend of mine did a TV thing about it, but she basically fell in love with a young man and brought him into the house, and they lived in a sort of a weird threesome.
Well, there's a show right there. Let's probably cut this out and then work on that as an idea.
And then Kenneth Williams, of course, ended it all, and
and just generally very lonely and quite
yeah
sort of had a lot of demons by all accounts.
This has gone really
what
dark.
Strange it has. Let's end it there. Yeah.
Oh no.
Well, I think it's a brilliant. I guess the question is it a guilty pleasure or just a pleasure? And in a way, I think all carry-ons, just because they're such an institution and because of what they meant to me as a child and as a teen, I don't think I'm going to call it a guilty pleasure. I think it's just a damn
really?
Right pleasure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does that mean I have to come up with something else?
No, that means you've failed.
Oh, no. Okay.
No. I just sometimes I think it's worth, you know, it's like some films go through the irony watershed, as it were. So I was chatting to, we had a guest a couple of weeks back, Jessica Knappett, and she picked Legally Blonde.
Mm.
And we were talking about how Dirty Dancing for years was a guilty pleasure, but now it seems that the irony's just gone and it's just people just love it.
Right.
It's not like a film that you're like, oh, I know it's shit, but I love it. It's just, oh, I love it.
Mm.
And maybe that happens with lots of time.
Yeah, I suppose you know? So. Especially if something manages to not be forgotten, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, there's good reason that we're still talking about carry-on films.
Exactly. So, but it's still a brilliant choice. And I like the fact that it's an unusual carry-on.
Oh, thanks.
It's not the obvious one. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for speaking to me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good luck with... When's Moonwalkers out?
Well, it came out here actually a few weeks ago
in America, yeah.
And it comes out in the UK in May, the end of May.
Okay, so watch out for Moonwalkers. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I'm going to end with my choice of song, and you know it seems only appropriate to end with this. It's the Carry On theme, which we all know and love. Thank you very much. Join us next week.